This is edition number 1999 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 9th of January 2026. Hello and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just one item from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 7 in the morning and sets at around 4 in the afternoon. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 8th of January. I am Bill Newby Grant, and my fellow readers are
Jane John,
Robert Watton,
and Jill Mellows.
The magazine supplement, which includes The Sound of the Woods in January, Talking with a Norfolk Blacksmith, A Problem with Dogs, and a Norfolk Parson's Famous Tales follows later. But first, fight to reopen health centre will continue. Fishermen accused of causing flooding to holiday homes in bid to save yard. And smallholding dream turns into a nightmare. However, we lead with mother in row over hazardous walking route for school children. Emma Daniels lives in Clye with her 13-year-old son Jacob, who attends Sheringham High School. To get to the school, teenagers have to take a coast hopper bus in the morning at a well-lit stop in the village centre and a school bus back in the afternoon. However, the afternoon drop-off point is close to the entrance of the Norfolk Wildlife Trust's Clye Marshes Reserve, which is around a 25-minute walk away. This includes walking along a rural coastal path, which has been described as hazardous in extreme conditions on a sign by the Wildlife Trust, as well as crossing the A149 twice. And despite efforts to raise the concern with Norfolk County Council, officials argued that the path is suitable and that it falls within the 1.5-mile radius that high school children are expected to walk to access their school transport. So now, Mrs. Daniels has appealed her case for the route to be reviewed. She said, "The coastal path that the transport team are directing children to use is frequently muddy, waterlogged, and at times impassable, particularly during winter. As a result, children are forced to walk on muddy grass or uneven ground, significantly increasing the risk of slips, falls, and injury." Mrs. Daniels also said that there is a sign warning walkers that the ground is unstable and that it may be hazardous in extreme weather conditions. "It is not acceptable. I walked it myself, and it just isn't an option," she added. Instead, Mrs. Daniels has proposed an alternative route. For 1 week in the term, the school bus drove up Old Woman's Lane, looped through Clye Village, and dropped students closer to Limekiln Close. She said the driver confirmed that it added, quotes, "very little time to the journey," and could not see why it would not work permanently. This route would remove the need to cross the A149, avoids isolated routes, and mirrors the morning collection point, Mrs. Daniels argued. She said, "The morning arrangements clearly demonstrate that a safer and more suitable option already exists and is operationally viable. Just because it's the way they have always done it, this doesn't make it a safe way that it should be done." The council spokesman said, "We seek to ensure safe and practical travel for all students, and our assessment deemed a safe off-carriageway route is available in this instance, in line with our current transport policy. We have invited the resident to formally appeal the decision, should they wish, and will review the situation again based on any further information received."
Campaigners have pledged to continue their fight to reopen a mothballed aftercare health centre as their fight goes into its third year. The Save Benjamin Court campaign was launched shortly after the reablement service in Cromer was shut without public consultation in June 2023. Benjamin Court had provided short-term care beds for patients well enough to leave hospital but not ready to return home. But as it enters the third year since it was closed, campaigners have promised to continue battling to see the site reused. Martin Booth, a spokesman for the group, said, We will take stock of what we have done up to now and what our prospects are for the coming year. The government's proposal for neighbourhood health hubs seems to be entirely in line with what we are campaigning for, yet they are not actually proposing anything for North Norfolk, the area with the highest proportion of older people in the country. We will keep lobbying for what we know is right, in the knowledge that at local level there is some real interest in reopening Benjamin Court, which is being discussed by local authority representatives and NHS chiefs. It comes as new figures have revealed that over the past 5 years, A&E medics have dealt with a huge number of cases that could have been handled by GPs or pharmacists. Almost 1.9 million people turned up to emergency departments with a headache. Almost 1.4 million cases of people sought help for a cough and 1.2 million for a sore throat, according to a press association analysis. Mr. Booth added, "These figures highlight the ludicrous situation in North Norfolk, where Benjamin Court, which provided vital local health services in Cromer and beyond for many years, sits unused, mothballed, and ready to reopen at a time when the NHS is crying out for the expansion of the neighbourhood healthcare. The campaign will be holding a meeting on January the 23rd at 6 p.m. in the Cromer Community Centre to discuss its plans."
Fishermen fighting to save a village's centuries-old industry have been accused of causing flooding to neighbouring holiday homes after their yard expanded. The group from Sea Pauling, near Hemsby, are currently locked in a planning row with holiday home owners over their site in the Marhams, who say it has become too intensified. In the latest development, neighbours living at Bonheur, who have owned their home for 46 years, have claimed building work has caused drainage issues to their property. A lengthy report has been submitted to North Norfolk District Council to support this claim, which includes a series of photographs of flooding and satellite images showing how the site has been developed. It has been published as part of a retrospective application to keep the changes at the yard after the previous threat of enforcement action was dropped by council officials. The family who own Bonheur, who are understood to be from Swaffham, said, "We are still concerned by the development in its current form, and in particular how the unauthorised works and operations carried out from the site are having an adverse impact on our everyday lives. In particular, the threat of regular localised flooding. We fear that this situation will only get worse should planning permission be granted. They worryingly raising of ground levels by creating a hard standing has contributed to the problem, while also questioning whether effective drainage has been installed." The objection letter continued, "We have experienced increased groundwater levels each winter since development began, leading to access problems in our driveway each year and flooding of our property. This has never occurred before in any year of our 46 years of ownership, and we have consistently used the property at all times of year, being a large local Norfolk family living and working in the county." The report says the flooding has caused extensive damp issues and damage to the walls and puts the blame on surface water and a lack of drainage. However, David Will, who is acting as agent for the fishermen, has dismissed the claims, stating the internal drainage board has not objected to the application. Environment agency officials have also not objected. He said the cause of the flooding was an unusual run of circumstances after heavy rain that filled the yard's tributaries and drains to overflowing. An extremely high tide coming upstream forced floodwater to break banks, particularly to the Norfolk marshes. He added that problems with an Anglian water main contributed to the problems. "To blame the boatyard is nonsense," he said. "While there have been objections from neighbours, there has been an outpouring of support locally, with more than 20 people writing to the council to defend the fishermen. Local councillor Harry Blathwaite has called for the fishing industry to be supported. He said, "This piece of land has been used for this purpose for the last 20 plus years and has become a vital part of the fishing fleet's operation. The fishing fleet's activity is an important part of Sea Pawling's local economy, without which it would be even more reliant on tourism." The row over the yard in Sea Pawling began after holiday owners complained to NNDC about being disturbed by the activities of the fishermen. They say work on the site had intensified, arguing the yard has become more industrial over the years, with bigger boats with more equipment now operating from there. The fishermen say three generations have operated from the site and have not received any complaints until now. They catch herring, crabs, lobster, whelks, bass and mackerel in the waters off the village. A decision on the application is expected to be made in the coming months.
It is a dream held by many of escaping the bustle of city life for life on the coast, where beautiful sandy beaches and charming villages await. But, as one couple from Nottingham found out, there can be a catch. Phil Merry and his partner, Amy Parkinson, hoped to escape to a simple life of living in a caravan overlooking the North Sea in Trimmingham, having bought a plot of land for £30,000 as part of their semi-retirement plans. It was going to be their little slice of heaven. And the pair planned to use the half-acre plot in North Norfolk as a small holding and campsite to bring in some income. Their home in Nottingham, about 130 miles away, has been put on the market and the sale is due to be completed in February. The only problem with their dream is that the plot of land they have bought is at risk of falling into the sea. The couple, who are in their 40s, have now realised they have bought a pig in a poke, which a local councillor has said is only good for grazing goats. The land is right on the cliff top, along what is one of the fastest eroding coastlines in Europe. It sits about 50 metres away from the edge, and gaining any sort of planning permission for the land, even to put a caravan there, would be unlikely due to the erosion risk. The cliffs are made up of sand and clay and are particularly vulnerable to storms and surface water runoff. Rules are in place to prevent any new developments from taking place in these at-risk zones. The couple have now put the land back on the market, but they doubt they will recoup much of what they have already spent. Mr. Merry, who is a locksmith and runs a hardware store, has not criticised Watson's, the estate agent who sold them the land, but he has accused North Norfolk District Council's planning department and his local councillor of failing to show much sympathy for their plight. During a call with the planning department, he could hear people laughing in the background as he explained his predicament. Meanwhile, Angie Fitch-Tillett, Conservative councillor for Trimmingham, told him that he should have done his research and that he has bought a worthless piece of land that is only good for grazing goats. Mr. Merry said, "We didn't know about the blanket ban on new developments. We love Norfolk and have been visiting for the past 20 years. Miss Fitch-Tillett admits she was a little blunt, but that she wanted to be realistic with Mr. Merry. While the plot is set back 50 metres from the edge, further away than some existing houses, Trimmingham's cliffs are at high risk of collapsing into the sea due to groundwater making them unstable. She said, "I feel extremely sorry for him. It's a situation we face all along the coast. It's one of the fastest eroding in Europe." The plight of people buying at-risk properties was recently raised by council officials at an Environment, Food and Rural Affairs inquiry into coastal erosion. Rob Goodliffe, Coastal Transition Manager at NNDC, told ministers that there is currently no requirement for estate agents to disclose coastal erosion risk, stating that potential purchasers are unable to make informed decisions about house purchases. Estate agents have defended these sales, stating buyers know the risks and that it gives owners the chance to make some money through selling their properties before they are lost to the sea. NNDC officials believe estate agents should be more upfront about the risks associated with certain properties. A spokesman said, "This part of the North Norfolk coast has been eroding for many thousands of years due to the action of the sea and impact of groundwater. Erosion is not always identified or flagged in sales or as part of the conveyancing process. We believe that coastal erosion is already considered as material information, and when properties are advertised for sale, they should include information on the risk from erosion. If a property owner believes they have been missold, there are routes for this to be considered further. For Mr. Merry, the pair will consider their next steps, but will continue exploring opportunities to escape to Norfolk."
Controversial plans to build 40 new homes in a Norfolk village are set to be approved despite neighbours' strong objections. Developers had lodged the proposal with Broadland Council for the scheme in Buxton, near Aylsham, resulting in backlash from the community. Villagers were concerned about the increased traffic on a dangerous road and the strain on the local schools and health services. But despite these fears, a planning officer has recommended the council's planning committee should approve the plans next week. The new housing would be built across 5 acres of farmland in between Aylsham Road and Bure Valley Railway. The developers expect the majority of the dwellings will be two-storey, with 4 being bungalows and 10 of the properties earmarked for affordable rent and 4 for affordable home ownership. The planning statement said, "The parish will continue to be a vibrant, inclusive community nestled in a tranquil rural setting. The proposed development will preserve its peace and quiet, respect its heritage, and strengthen its connections with the community and the wider area." More than 20 objections were submitted to the plans for people living nearby. One comment said, "I feel that the infrastructure of the village and the local area is not able to support all those extra homes. The school, doctor surgeries, health services, and shops are already under enormous strain." Another added, "I am concerned with how this development will contribute to this already dangerous road." However, in the report for the planning committee, the officer argued that it would provide economic benefits in the area as well as addressing a shortfall in housing supply. The report added that there are benefits with the proposed footpath improvements, allowing people to walk to the primary school, village shop and post office instead of driving. And while there were concerns about the impact of the development on highway safety, the officer noted that the highway authority had not objected to the plans. A decision will be made by the council at a meeting on January the 7th, which will begin at 10 a.m. at the Horizon Centre in Norwich.
An array of medieval wall paintings in a Norfolk church are set to be preserved in a major project. All Saints Church in Crosthwaite, near North Walsham, has been awarded a £42,340 grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund to begin the process of conserving the historic paintings inside. With the initial funding, the church has commissioned preliminary surveys and had plans drawn up regarding the best way to protect them for future generations. Peter Williams, churchwarden at Honing and Crosthwaite Churches and project leader, said, "We are thrilled to have received this initial support from the National Lottery Heritage Fund. Thanks to National Lottery players, we can now develop our plans to protect and conserve these remarkable survivals put here by our distant forebears. They can then continue to be enjoyed by all those who pass this way for many years to come. It is hoped that the church may be awarded a further £437,000 to enable the conservation work to take place on the 11 panels depicting the Passion of Christ. It would also include essential repairs to areas including the chancel arch, plaster and the installation of new drains to reduce the risk of damp. The National Lottery Heritage Fund's policy is that all grant applications over £250,000 are assessed in two rounds, with an initial development phase to lay the foundations. The Grade 1 listed church dates back around 700 years and retains several nationally significant medieval features, such as wall paintings, rood screen, and a bell. The square tower was reduced in height in 1910 after becoming unstable. It is one of the two churches in the parish of Honing with Crosthwaite and is still used for worship despite a lack of immediate community and connections to main services.
A man in his 40s was seriously injured in a three-vehicle crash involving a lorry. The incident happened on Tuesday, December the 9th at 1:20 p.m. on the A140 between Erpingham and Hanworth near the junction of Church Road. It involved a black Volkswagen Caddy van which collided with a white Ford B-Max and a DAF lorry. The driver of the Ford B-Max, a man in his 80s, and the driver of the DAF lorry, a man in his 50s, both sustained minor injuries. At first, the Volkswagen driver's injuries were thought to be minor. However, on Friday, January the 2nd, he was taken by ambulance to Addenbrookes Hospital with a serious injury believed to relate to the collision. Norfolk Police are now seeking witnesses and appealing for anyone with dash camera footage or information about the incident to contact them. Quoting the reference, NC 091-220-25-206. Inquiries into the circumstances of the incident are ongoing.
The risk of a cyber attack causing huge disruption to services run by Norfolk's biggest council is growing, say concerned County Hall officials. Norfolk County Council's security systems have been fending off attempts to disrupt services or steal data for years. But officers say the risk of a major attack is growing more likely. Last year saw several attacks which cost big British businesses dearly, with Jaguar, Land Rover, Marks & Spencer and Harrods, some of the biggest firms to be targeted. But local councils have also been hit. Suffolk County Council's website went down in September when it suffered a denial of service attack, with its website deliberately overloaded with traffic. The Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster City Council were hit at the end of last year and confirmed data had been copied and taken away. At a meeting of County Hall's Conservative-controlled Cabinet on Monday, January the 5th, councillors were asked to agree to increase the risk rating around the possibility of an attack causing a loss of the council's key IT systems. Council risk ratings are ranked on a scale of 1 to 20, and officials say the cyber attack risk, already rated as amber, needs to be increased from 8 to 12. Officers said the loss of core or key ICT systems, communications or utilities for a significant period as a result of a cyber attack, loss of power, physical failure, fire or flood, or supplier failure would result in a failure to deliver IT-based services, leading to disruption to critical service delivery, a loss of reputation and additional costs. Ransomware is currently the highest risk cybersecurity threat. While every effort is made to avoid such a security breach, it is also important to ensure we are able to recover as quickly as possible if we become infected. Ransomware refers to software used by cybercriminals to access the computer systems of their victims, which can then be encrypted or data stolen until a ransom is paid. The council has been taking measures to protect itself from such attacks, including bringing in consultants to review its security measures. It has been regularly updating protection measures and running exercises to test its response to a cyber attack. Andrew Bailey, Governor of the Bank of England, recently said he thought cyber attacks were one of the biggest threats to UK financial stability. He said it was critically important to work together to guard against them.
Football rapist accused of having secret phone in cell. A former Premier League footballer, jailed for raping a woman as she slept, is accused of having a secret phone in his prison cell in Norfolk. Nathan Ashton, 38, who played for England at youth level, was serving part of a 16-year sentence at HMP Bure when a number of illicit communications items were discovered. Norwich Magistrates Court was told a search at the specialist prison, which houses male sex offenders, had unearthed items including a DAB radio adapted to include 4G Wi-Fi, a SIM card and USB components. Ashton, who has since been transferred to HMP Five Wells in Northamptonshire and appeared before court via video link, pleaded not guilty to four charges of possession of items banned from inmates. His case was committed at Norwich Crown Court with a preliminary hearing on January the 13th. Ashton was jailed following the rape of a woman in Romford in February 2023. At the time, he was a semi-professional footballer, but once turned out for Fulham in the Premier League and came through the ranks at Charlton Athletic when they were a top-flight club. He had loan spells at Crystal Palace and Millwall in the mid-2000s.
Drivers have been warned to take care on the roads after a rise in crashes in Norfolk. Norfolk Fire and Rescue has revealed that it attended 99 road collisions in November. This was 21 more than the previous month and more than any other month in 2025. Crashes in November included a fatal collision between a car and a lorry in Attlebridge, which left a man in his 70s dead. Destiny Devereux, 12, died after being hit by a car in Wheating. A spokesman for the fire service said, "This holiday time, please take extra care on the roads. Drive safely to help ensure you and those around you have a safe and happy new year." There was also a rise in the number of emergency calls the fire service received, with 1,341 in October and 1,449 in November. Crews also attended 14 more building fires than the previous month, going from 59 to 73. Other statistics included 719 home fire security checks, up 8 from October.
An inquest date has been set for a man whose body was recovered by a lifeboat crew on the North Norfolk coast. Anthony Gribbins, 52, died at the RNLI lifeboat station in Wells on April 23rd last year. An inquest opening at Norfolk Coroner's Court last year heard his provisional cause of death was multiple injuries due to immersion in water. Alcohol consumption, ischemic heart disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease were also listed as contributory factors in his death. It was confirmed at a brief review hearing on January the 2nd that a full inquest will take place at the Coroner's Court at 10 p.m. on May 22nd. Mr. Gribbins worked as a lorry driver and lived in St. Helens, Merseyside. He was located after the crew was paged by the Coast Guard just after 2:30 p.m. but was pronounced dead at the station.
An inquest has been suspended into the death of a man who died after a fire at his home. Robert Button, 73, suffered serious burns after the blaze, believed to have started in a doorway, broke out at his home off Ostend Road in Woolcot on December the 7th. He was taken to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital but died during the early hours of December the 8th. Mr. Button's provisional cause of death was listed as multiple organ failure and burns. During a brief review hearing at Norfolk Coroner's Court, Area Coroner Yvonne Blake suspended the inquest due to ongoing criminal proceedings. A further pre-inquest review hearing is scheduled for 9:30 a.m. at the same court on July the 6th. Mr. Button's neighbour, Christopher Brooks, 40, was arrested at the scene and appeared at Norwich Crown Court on December the 10th. He has been accused of the murder of Mr. Button, along with criminal damage to his Nissan Navara. A plea and trial preparation hearing is set for February the 9th, with a provisional trial date scheduled for June the 8th.
A house builder has pledged 3 years of funding to help support vital air ambulance research. Norfolk-based Able Homes will donate £15,000 to support the second year of a breakthrough project by the East Anglian Air Ambulance, the EAAA, to improve brain injury diagnosis at accident scenes. The company has pledged a total of £50,000 in funding over the next 3 years. At the beginning of 2025, Able Homes donated £11,000 to launch the project, which is trialling a device that can detect brain bleeds using a rapid blood test conducted at the scene. Tony Able, chairman of Able Homes, said, "We are proud to have been supporters for many years and to have contributed to the costs of this important piece of work. We felt it was important to see it through, which is why we have agreed to help fund the second year of the project as well." Dr. James Price from the EAAA said, "We are truly grateful to Able Homes for their continued support for this groundbreaking work."
A number of Norfolk children were left waiting in the cold after a delay in buses to take them to school. The delay affected pupils heading to Broadland High Ormiston Academy in Hoveton on Monday morning. Temperatures low as -4 centigrade were reported on the day, with many buses due to arrive before 8 a.m. One parent said that pupils were stood waiting at Salhouse Road, as well as bus stops across Salhouse and Rackheath, for more than an hour. They added, "The school got in touch at 8:30 a.m. to say they were aware buses hadn't been sent." A spokeswoman for Ormiston Academies Trust, which runs the school, said, "There was a slight delay to the arrival of school buses this morning due to an administrative error with the company. However, this was rectified with a replacement bus which was sent, and we have communicated with students and families involved." In an email seen by this paper, the Academy confirmed the bus was sent out at 8:30 a.m. with services home running as normal.
A campaign to bring more smiles to young lives has raised more than £7,000 through community generosity. The Help Paint a Smile fundraiser by East Anglia's Children's Hospices, each, brought in £7,003 across 54 charity shops in the region throughout December. Customers were invited to add a 25p donation at the till, with a target of raising £25 per shop each week to fund 6 months of weekly art therapy sessions. Janine Woodcock, Retail Central Support Manager at Each, said, "We're incredibly proud of our customers and retail teams. It was moving to see how strongly our communities responded." She went on to say, "This campaign didn't just meet expectations, it smashed them, and the funds raised will have a direct impact on the children and families receiving our care. The total, boosted by a strong final week of donations, surpassed the original £5,400 goal."
A festive dip in the North Sea was cancelled because of dangerous weather conditions. Organisers of the Sheringham New Year's Day dip officially cancelled the event for the second year in a row. They said it was for the safety of the swimmers as the maximum wind speed was expected to reach 43 miles per hour and waves were forecast to exceed 8 feet. In a Facebook post, organisers said, "Despite the monumental effort from our community to find lifeguards and the incredible support from every single one of you who booked a slot, Mother Nature has had the final word." They added, "The safety of our dippers and the volunteers there to keep you safe on the day must always come first. And unfortunately, with the forecast as it is, we have taken the really difficult decision to cancel the event." Their 2025 event was cancelled due to a yellow weather warning, also for wind. The organisation is hoping to hold an event at a later date and ask people to watch out for more information.
Families living along the erosion-threatened North Norfolk coast are facing uncertainty after officials warned burials will need to be exhumed to avoid them falling into the sea. Hundreds of people have the daunting prospect of having to rebury their loved ones in the coming decades due to coastal erosion affecting Haysborough's church. Two other sites in Trimmingham and Munsley are also at risk. The issue was highlighted after Coastwise, a North Norfolk District Council scheme, conducted an investigation into the options available at the sites. The situation is causing distress for some, with villagers calling for clear plans and timeframes to be set out to provide more certainty over what will happen in the future. They want to know what will happen to the remains before they themselves die. Others are left wondering whether they will still be able to be interred alongside partners and family members in plots they have already reserved. Frank Mason, 69, and David Wright, 66, are among those whose family members are buried at Haysborough, and they say they are becoming increasingly frustrated. Mr. Wright regularly visits the graveyard to visit his son's burial, who died from bone cancer at the age of 17 in 2004. He said, "My wife has suffered considerably with the loss of our son, and I have some serious concerns how this will affect her, myself and the family. To go through an exhumation and reburial will cause many families upset, stress and worry. It needs to be handled sympathetically, but I worry it is going to be a last-ditch effort." Mr. Mason, who can trace his family history in Haysborough back through several generations, says currently he is in limbo. Both his parents, Ethel and Fred, are buried at the site. He said, "If they are going to be moved, I want to see it done now. This was meant to be their final resting place, but it isn't going to be anymore. We need a concrete plan, and I want to see my parents moved before I also pass away." Visitors can hear waves thumping against the ageing sea defences, even on calmer days, from St. Mary the Virgin's Church's graveyard, which is located about 80 metres away from the cliffs. How long will it take for the sea to reach the graveyard is uncertain and will be dependent on changing weather patterns. In a recent 20-year period, about 100 metres of land has been lost to the sea in parts of the village. It has been predicted that the rate of erosion could continue at this pace for the next 20 years. Updated Environment Agency projections say in 25 years' time, the cemetery could be at serious risk of erosion and could be lost altogether by 2105. However, officials warn that significant storms could advance this timeline, as has occurred in recent decades. Building new sea defences is not technically, environmentally or economically feasible, the Coastwise report warned. Mr. Mason worries the pace of erosion could be quick, giving the graveyard between 20 to 30 years before the sea reaches it, judging by the pace of erosion in the village. "Several metres can go in one night," said Mr. Mason. "The cliffs here are slightly better, but further east they are mostly sand, which will be where it comes in." Both the council and the Diocese of Norwich, which is responsible for the graveyard, say it is up to the local people to decide what action to take, and they are encouraging villagers to discuss the matter. The cost of exhuming thousands of remains would be costly and could run into millions of pounds. Matters are complicated at Haysborough due to the mass grave of 119 sailors from HMS Invincible, which sank off the coast in 1801. Another particularly sensitive burial is that of Thomas Marshall, a 12-year-old boy who was murdered by paedophile shopkeeper Kevin Roberts, then 52, in Eccles in August 1997. Rob Goodliffe, NNDC's Coastal Transition Manager, said, "There are a number of approaches as to how the churchyard could be managed over a period of time. These are still all to be developed, considered, agreed, and put into place with input from the church and local people." Mr. Wright worries the legal implications could stall any action to prevent remains falling into the sea. He said, "There will be so much legal red tape, I worry that once lawyers get involved, it will grow too expensive. If people don't want a body exhumed, what then? We will have to do what we need to do to make it right."
One in nine Norfolk police officers had time off for mental health reasons last year, according to new figures which raise concerns there is a sick note culture at the force. The number of officers signed off work on mental health grounds rose by around a quarter compared to 2024, and are more than double what they were in 2016. The startling figures will prompt questions over what has led to the steep rise and what the impact is on the effectiveness of the force. Senior officers say that the increase is because officers now have greater confidence to report mental health issues rather than a rise in the conditions themselves. Meanwhile, the Police Federation, which represents rank and file officers, has suggested the surge could be down to the impact of having to monitor protests outside asylum hotels in recent months. However, the Taxpayers Alliance, a pressure group focused on public sector transparency, said the figures stretched credulity to breaking point. Elliot Keck, its campaigns director, said, "The sick note culture that has infected the public sector is a disaster for taxpayers, but also for the many hard-working staff that are having to bear the burden caused by the soaring rates of sick leave. The fact that one in nine police officers in Norfolk are taking time off for mental health reasons stretches credulity to breaking point, even if there are real underlying pressures underlying some of this. From town halls to police stations to Whitehall, public sector bosses need to bring in much stricter rules and reporting requirements and ensure that the number of sick days taken starts to come down." The new figures show that 212 of Norfolk Constabulary's 1,868 officers are signed off on mental health grounds between January and November 2025. The total for the whole of 2024 was just 1,073. Andy Simons, chairman of the county's Police Federation branch, said the protests outside asylum hotels meant officers had missed out on rest days. The protests began in the Summer Park outside the Park Hotel in Diss and the Brook Hotel in Beauthorpe. The Beauthorpe demonstrations have continued, and the site still requires a heavy police presence on occasions. Mr. Simon said, "We've seen officers exhausted, going from pillar to post, having their rest days axed every weekend during the summer to police these protests. Rest days are precious. Officers need time to rest and spend time with their families. They typically only get 2 weekends off every 10 weeks. Mr. Simon said that the protests had compounded already intense workloads, rising stress levels and a growing exposure to traumatic incidents. The data obtained via a Freedom of Information request showed the proportion of officers taking mental health leave has nearly doubled since 2016, when around 1 in 16 were absent on mental health grounds. It is estimated that a modern police officer is exposed to between 400 and 600 traumatic incidents over the course of their career, whereas a member of the public is only expected to witness one or two. Mr. Simon said, "On a regular set of shifts, officers are dealing with this kind of trauma day in, day out. There's simply no time to sit down, decompress, and talk about what they've been exposed to." He added, "We need properly funded psychologists and psychiatrists. At the moment, there just isn't enough provision to meet the level of demand reflected in these figures." The figures come at a time of greater scrutiny over mental health related issues at other public sector organisations. A report by this newspaper in October found that the number of paramedics in the ambulance service taking time off for mental health reasons has tripled over the past decade. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary said the increase in mental health absences reflects greater confidence in reporting mental health concerns rather than a proportional rise in overall sickness. She added, "We are committed to creating a resilient and supportive working environment where mental health is prioritised and officers have access to the help they need."
Plans to build 550 homes on the Norfolk coast have been revamped following dozens of objections. Developers had sought permission from North Norfolk District Council for a 550-home development that would close the gap between Cromer and Roughton. The scheme promises 192 affordable homes, a 100-bed care facility, sports pitches for the town's football club, and new allotments, expanding the coastal population by more than 1,600 people. But it was met with a strong backlash from the community, alongside objections from Cromer Town Council, Norfolk County Council, and Active Travel England. Concerns were raised about traffic safety concerns on the surrounding roads, a lack of clarity on the sports provision, and whether the schools and health services in the area could cope. Now the applicant for the scheme, Innova, has submitted a series of amendments to the proposal in response to these comments. These include the removal of the northern vehicle access point on Norwich Road and the provision of an emergency access with pedestrian and cycle access to Roughton Road to the west. It also includes new off-site highway works along Roughton Road with a system of traffic calming measures to improve the connectivity to the town centre for those walking or cycling. Additional information has also been provided about the two adult sports pitches and parking proposed in the area identified for playing pitches. It is anticipated that the development would be built in three phases. The first phase would include 120 homes to the south and the roundabout from the Norwich Road, which would form the primary vehicular access point for the entire development. The second phase would include approximately 300 homes to the west of the site and would start on the sports and community facilities as well as the elderly accommodation. Phase three would focus on the north and east of the site and would complete the works on the community spaces. To view or comment on the plans, search PO/25/0492 in the North Norfolk District Council's planning portal.
Police have been unable to identify those responsible for naming a rape victim on social media after the post was deleted, it has emerged. Norfolk's chief constable had been urged by Judge Anthony Bate to launch an investigation after the name of the woman raped by Norfolk businessman Andrew Hubbard was being circulated online. The victims of sex offences are granted lifelong anonymity by the courts, and anyone who reveals their identity can be fined up to £5,000. Although an investigation was launched by police, A force spokesman said the case was now closed after all lines of inquiry were exhausted. Following digital inquiries, no suspect could be identified, as the original social media post and associated metadata is no longer available, said the spokesman. But the spokesman urged anyone with information about who may be responsible for the post to contact police. Judge Bate discovered the victim had been named online by members of the public during a hearing to discuss Hubbard's case at Norwich Crown Court. The 34-year-old who owned Lily Mays, formerly Kraft Burger, in Cromer, was convicted of rape in October after a trial. The case, which will now be sentenced in February, was listed in court earlier this month when the judge was informed of the situation. Sally Hobson, prosecuting, said she, the victim, has been named on social media. The prosecutor said this had added to the ongoing trauma being suffered by the victim. Judge Bate said the press had acted responsibly in its reporting of this case, adding, "But people in the wider community appear to know who it is and have named her. It's a very serious matter that I hope the Chief Constable treats with the utmost seriousness." Judge Bate said the identification of the victim has added to the anxiety she felt. The judge said action should be taken very urgently to find the people responsible for the posts. Hubbard, who intends to appeal his conviction, had been due to be sentenced on November the 15th. However, he has instructed a new barrister to represent him for the sentencing, and the judge agreed to adjourn the hearing, which will now take place on February the 13th. The judge has already told Hubbard, who was also convicted of controlling and coercive behaviour, that he should prepare to go to prison. The former cafe owner, who has denied all offences he faced, was found not guilty of another count of rape and cleared of an offence to kidnap and another offence of voyeurism. Earlier in the trial, the jury were directed to find him not guilty of another offence of escape from lawful custody. Hubbard, formerly of Hannah Close Sheringham, but now of St Mary's Close Rowton, was granted conditional bail after his conviction. He must live and sleep each night at the address and abide by a curfew between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m.
You are listening to edition number 1999 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 9th of January 2026. We have articles about a successful fruit farm, a nurse honoured by Queen Status Award, a traditional plough procession in Norfolk, and parents' poignant tribute in memory of 23-year-old son, plus the Mardler magazine supplement, and one obituary. But first we have two letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News with the topics Getting Ready for Panto and Words Are Easy for Council.
How are you going on together? That's that time of year again. Oh yes, that is. Our friends of Norfolk dialect are busy getting ready to present this year's famous panto. That's going to be Snow White this year. She were a lovely little old mother, weren't she? I say the friends are busy, but they aren't doing any rehearsals. They never do. But they will be making some scenery, I expect. So do you get yourself down to East Tuddenham Village Hall on Sunday, 18th January at 2 p.m. for an afternoon of Norfolk entertainment, a raffle, a cup of tea and a shortcake. Oh, we'll be announcing the winners of the Trosher Creative Writing Competition, what we ran through the summer and all. Keep that dialect alive. We hope you had a very happy Old Year's night and wish you a peaceful and prosperous 2026. Yours obediently, the gal Anne.
Words are easy for council. It's good to see Norfolk County Council, NCC, starting the year by saying they want to listen to communities in their online posts. I very much hope this marks a real change in behaviour, not just warm words and platitudes. Here in Sheringham, NCC have consistently refused to listen to the clear and united voices of our community regarding Ottendorf Green, the transport hub, and in particular, the demolition of the bus shelter. Residents, local representatives and Sheringham Town Council have all raised serious concerns. When challenged, not just by the community but also by the Department for Transport and Secretary of State to amend the plans and get on with it, NCC instead behaved like petulant toddlers, abandoning the site altogether and leaving behind what many in the community feel are unsafe and unacceptable bus stops on Cromer Road. That is not listening. That is not partnership working, and it's certainly not serving the community. Now is the time for Norfolk County Council to come to the table properly. They must urgently engage with our community, Sheringham Town Council and local representatives to discuss a clear way forward, consider the real and practical options available, deliver bus improvements, heritage and environmental improvements, and most importantly, the greater safety in this area, which this project did not address. It is vital that Sheringham Town Council are firm in insisting that Norfolk County Council take responsibility to engage, to listen and to resolve this, not expect the Town Council to find solutions or fund works that sit squarely with the County Council. If NCC are serious about listening in 2026, this is the moment to prove it. It is not the responsibility of the Town Council to pick up the pieces of a failed process. It is the responsibility of Norfolk County Council to act as a responsible, supportive and accountable authority to the people they work for and are supposed to serve. Words are easy. Listening and acting with urgency is what matters. That letter was from Councillor Liz Whittington, NNDC Sheringham North Ward.
Reginald Frank Ephraim Amis passed away peacefully on December the 11th, 2025. A dearly loved husband of the late Heather and loving father to Leslie and Terry, a much loved granddad and great-granddad, will be sadly missed by all his family. The funeral will take place at Cromer Parish Church on Thursday the 15th of January 2026 at 2 p.m. No flowers, please, but donations, if wished, to the North Norfolk Cats Lifeline Trust or Big C, care of Cromer and District Independent Funeral Services, 32 West Street, Cromer, NR279DS.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. We include Forging a Local Legend, Are Dogs Always Welcome? And the Reverend Wilbert Audrey. But first, Missel Thrush Song breaks the silence of the woods. One day this January, on a morning of glass-sharp light, when perhaps the grass has been crisply rhymed in the night, a domino will topple. Its fall will seem like almost nothing at the time, just an early bird in song. But dominoes toppling topple dominoes, and butterflies fluttering unleash unseen earthquakes far away. To be sure, a bird in song is of itself remarkable. That evolution should have honed the avian syrinx to produce such varied and such beautiful sound, not for human benefit, but to establish territory and to woo a mate, this is objectively astounding. But the wonder of this January song does not end here. our songster is a missel thrush. His song, for in almost all our British birds a songster is inevitably a male, is among the very first to break the silence of the woods each year. Missel thrush song is rich and musical, but, fading as its phrases swiftly do to silence, it has an indefinable air of sadness. Such happiness this January day, to hear the clamouring of the mottle-chested bird for life, its right to breed for spring, and yet so strangely melancholy too. Melancholy, yes, but powerful. Though spring is weeks away, the sun's heat weak, and there are endless days of bleak grey rain to come, our missel thrush's song is spring's first domino. Stirred, perhaps, or irked, by his stentorious neighbour's voice above, a wren may spin his tangled web of song this January day, for the first time since October. Or, from a tattered bramble clump, a dirt-brown dunnock may be tempted into breathy, still uncertain voice. Spring's dominoes begin to topple all around. By February, days are just a little longer. The sun is fractionally warmer. On bright days, by late morning, there's heat enough to lull goshawks into courtship. These thrilling, muscle-chested birds, silent slayers in conifer plantations all over Norfolk, plunge and swoop above dull winter stands of spruce and larch and pine, claiming their place on earth, their deep stick nests, their moment in the timeless chain of life. Beneath them, tiny by comparison, great tits give their rocking songs. Their message is the same. This place is ours, for now, to hand on genes through generations. By March, the dominoes of spring are toppling fast. Though chiff-chaffs are now quite common as Norfolk winter birds, this month our residents are joined by chiff-chaffs that have wintered in North Africa. The scraping, three-note voice of sandwich terns is heard along the coast by late March too. They have wintered even further south on the beaches of West Africa. On days of warmth in March, insects are suddenly in evidence everywhere. Clouds of amorous non-biting midges hang above sunny footpaths, and overwintered adult butterflies, brimstones, peacocks and small tortoiseshells, take at last to tentative flight, powered by gathering warmth. Beneath them, at ground level, queen buff-tailed bumblebees blunder between early flowers, buzzing noisily. By night, still frigid ponds and ditches purr with frogs and pipe with toads, each of them calling for a mate. Spring's imperative is clear. Be heard, be found, pass on the ancient code that's written in your cells. Make life. April, May and June are nothing less than riotous, dominoes toppling everywhere you look and listen. Birdsong becomes louder, more demanding, every day at dawn. Chitinous swarms of dragonflies rustle over waterways, hunting midges. They, in their turn, are hunted by the hobby. This dashing falcon, mustachioed like Errol Flynn, arrives each spring from Africa to prey on swallows, martins, dragonflies, and all the summer folk. By July and August, the year has tipped towards the darker days again. The lush, fresh green of spring and early summer is turning gold with age. But there are countless colours still to come this year, and countless dominoes still to fall. The marshes of our coast are bruised with purple now, in the billion blossoms of common sea lavender. The golden constellations of sea aster are among them, and the soft pink puffs of thrift. On the beach nearby is all the noise and drama of a colony of nesting birds. Little terns shimmer silver in the summer sun. Oyster catchers demand attention, both with piercing voices, with carrot bills and bright pied plumage. Ringed plovers take a different path. Their colours have evolved to hide them among pebbles, their mottled eggs to be invisible on the beach. By September, rooks and jackdaws have already gathered in their winter hordes, decking woods with black. The first of winter's migrants arrive in September too, teal from Fennoscandia, widgeon from Russia, and pink-footed geese from Iceland. In October, our January singing missel thrush is joined by winter thrushes from Scandinavia and Siberia. slim red wings bringing fizzing calls and black-tailed field fares chuckling loudly as they come. Then winter. Dark, damp, cold and challenging. Challenging for many species, especially vertebrates, which struggle to find sufficient calories to make it through each day and night. Challenging for humans too, as we mourn the dying of the light, the dull grey weeks of drizzle and the silence. By December, nothing but the robin's rueful trickle can be heard in woods and gardens. But then in January, on a day of winter gloves and coats and hats, there comes the promise of all the warmth and colour and sound ahead. As you wander through the woods or beneath a tall tree on the common, you hear the loud yet strangely tragic fluting of the missel thrush. Dominoes begin to topple, your mind leaps forward to the spring and summer, then the autumn, and you are deeply grateful to the missel thrush for telling of the coming year, the ceaseless patterns of the natural world, and to all the other lives with which we share our precious Norfolk, for giving music, drama and delight to all our days, for giving life. That article by Nick Atchison appeared in January 2026 in the issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, was Eric Stevenson the finest blacksmith of the 20th century? I met Eric Stevenson briefly in the late 80s in his thatched cottage on the edge of Wroxham at the heart of the Norfolk Broads. A fire was burning brightly, and one of the first things I noticed was a modest object in carved metal on the hearth. I remember it as it was made from a piece of square steel bar, a little under 2 inches on each side, and about 4 inches tall. It had been carved with chisels into an exquisite head of great detail. Asking if I could look at it, Eric said, "I made it." And that started a long conversation about his past and blacksmithing. Out came a photo album, and he spoke with immense but quiet pride of working on the gates of St Paul's Cathedral, being awarded his gold medal and his greatest work, the screen at St Nicholas's Church, Great Yarmouth, a project of 6 years. I had no idea I was sitting quietly with a true local legend. Other notable ironwork was for Norwich Cathedral and St Martin in the Fields in London. I was the first person to work on the gates there, St Paul's, since they were put in, he said, as he showed me the pictures during our talk. In my last few years at school, the place I found most calming and satisfying was the metal workshop, or, more specifically, the forge. There was something quite magical about the fire, metal, and hammer power that could turn two pieces of metal into one by fire welding. Not two pieces anymore, but one. Unlike working with wood, when two pieces will always be two pieces, even if they are glued together. In those days, power hammers, arc, and torch welding were not allowed, so it was all handwork. And it was wonderful. So when Eric started talking about his life and work, I was transported back to the sounds, smells and feelings of my school forge in a world of my own as I scrolled, welded and formed metal into what I thought were works of art. What a privilege. Blacksmithing is one of humanity's oldest crafts, with roots dating back to the Iron Age, evolving with the need to manipulate metal. The essential tools of forge, anvil, tongs and hammer have changed little over the centuries. Traditionally, a blacksmith's forge was central to village life, and medieval smiths crafted tools, horseshoes, gates, and essential hardware for village life. Industrialisation introduced water-powered trip hammers and then steam-powered equipment, yet true smithing has survived in the hands of dedicated craftspeople who preserve the tradition. In the 20th century, decorative ironwork was still in great demand, blending functionality with ornamentation. It is in this rich tradition that Eric Stevenson became a key figure. Eric came from a long blacksmithing tradition. He told me it went back over 200 years to Shadrach Stevenson of Surlingham in the late 18th century. But recorded in his hand-drawn family tree, there are two other smiths in the Stevenson line even before that, Isaac and Samuel. When his father died, while Eric was in his early 20s, he gave up a career in journalism to work in the family forge in Wroxham. The first gate he ever made, in the form of a spider's web, is in the grounds of nearby Hoveton Hall. Other works included village signs, weather vanes, farm tools, and many wrought iron gates. On July the 2nd, 1970, after 40 years at the anvil, Eric was awarded the Gold Medal and Freedom and Livery of the Worshipful Company of Blacksmiths by Mr. Joseph Diamond, Prime Warden of the Company, at Innkeeper's Hall in the City of London. It was the first ceremony to be filmed in the company's 600-year history. This story was broadcast by the BBC in February 1971 in the Look Stranger series, entitled By Hammer and Hand. The Worshipful Company of Blacksmiths is one of the livery companies of the City of London and is thought to have been founded in some form well before 1299. It was originally a trade guild, established to uphold standards of craftsmanship, regulate the training and conduct of apprentices, and protect members' interests in the trade of forging iron and, later, steel. The company received its royal charter from Queen Elizabeth I in 1571, allowing it to control blacksmithing standards in London and the surrounding areas and to enforce regulations. Eric, at his Wroxham Forge, was also the subject of a short BBC educational film, The Blacksmith, broadcast in February 1971, which is still available to view on the British Film Institute website. Eric's workshop in Wroxham, located just behind his home, functioned as both workplace and educational hub. The BBC film shows children visiting his forge, watching him forge steel, and even observing his mobile farriery setup, shoeing horses at Overstrand. According to local history accounts, he also provided mobile farrier services, crafting iron-wheeled tret carts, used around Wroxham Station for luggage handling, and guided local children in crafting bows and arrows, activities recounted by people who grew up in Wroxham. He is also reported to have driven the fire engine during local emergencies in the 1940s. At the 1956 Royal Norfolk Show, held at Anmer in the west of the county, his stand was visited by the late Queen Mother and Princess Margaret, and a fire screen made by Eric was purchased by the Sandringham estate. He and his wife Lily were very much part of the local community, Eric as scoutmaster and Lily as guide mistress. Eric even met Lord Baden-Powell during an inspection of the first Wroxham Sea Scouts aboard HMS Implacable during 1934. He also served on the parish council. In 1990, he retired from the council aged 82, ending 150 years of him and his ancestors serving as public officials in Wroxham. Eric's approach was highly traditional. Bar heating to white hot, freehand hammering, and intricate manual forging. He retired in 1977. Over his career, his work appeared in 10 English cathedrals. Although gas forges, welding, and powered hammers were available in his era, his legacy lies in his insistence on handmade precision, focusing on artistry over mechanisation. Blacksmithing has seen a revival across the UK and Ireland as both a heritage art and a contemporary craft discipline. New educational courses in ironcraft and ceremonial smithing echo the legacy of men like Eric. Historic preservation movements now restore gates and wrought iron installations by traditional methods, securing heritage while encouraging modern artisans to carry forward the tradition. Eric Stevenson's story lies at the intersection of craft, community, and cultural identity. His work decorates sacred places. His life enriched local history, and his educational work ensured forging remains more than a tradition. It became a narrative connecting generations. In an era dominated by industrial uniformity, his forge was a voice of human touch and artistic integrity. From the roar of the forge fire to the final strike of the hammer, blacksmithing remains one of the most visceral and human crafts. That article, by Whimsical of Warmack, was from Norfolk Magazine, January 2026 issue.
And now, I love dogs, but do owners have to take them everywhere? As a nation of dog lovers, there is no doubt that our canine friends bring a lot of joy, comfort, and companionship to millions of people. The saying that a dog is a man's best friend was backed up by a close, now late friend of mine, who asserted that dogs were better friends than any human being because they were trustworthy and loyal for their entire lifetime. Although we always had a family dog throughout my younger life, I have learned to live without one in later years, partly because my busy life did not give me time to look after one properly. In those days, the World Wide Web had not been invented, so keeping an eye via webcam on the welfare of the home alone dog was just not possible. And anyway, such isolation for a dog for long periods of the day seemed a bit unfair and selfish. Readers of this paper's letters page will know that dog fouling of pavements and public spaces has long been a bone of contention and filled many column inches. Nowadays, more often than not, dog walkers carry their own blue doggy bags to clean up after their pets. Of course, there are still some less responsible owners who do not, but it's far better than it used to be. But where do you draw the line with dogs when it comes to restaurants and hotels? In recent times, I seem to be encountering pooches in these places far more often. Eating lunch in a Norfolk hostelry recently, a couple arrived at the next table with two large dogs. The leads were tied to chair legs, but this did not confine the animals sufficiently to prevent them disturbing other diners whose tables were in close proximity. The couple did their best to admonish the dogs and keep them close to their table. But dogs will be dogs. And speaking of that, while shopping in the soft furnishing department at Norwich's John Lewis store, two ladies were hugely embarrassed when their accompanying pooch cocked its leg and relieved itself on one of the items for sale. One grabbed a towel from the stand and tried to soak up the puddle, but a John Lewis assistant came to their rescue and politely took over the accident. it was obviously not an uncommon incident. But I digress. Am I alone in thinking that there are more dogs now being welcomed, with their owners, into hospitality venues? I think I've found the answer. The scent of the hound pound. The website Restaurant claims that research shows the British hotel industry is potentially missing out on an additional £39 million per night by not allowing pets to stay on the premises. Apparently, a fifth of dog owners would happily pay an extra £25 a night if they were allowed to bring their pet with them for the stay. Many said they felt the break was spoiled by unnecessarily worrying about the pets left behind. If you log on to the internet, searching for accommodation, you will find a plethora of hotels and pubs promoting the fact that it is a dog-friendly establishment. I don't blame them for chasing the hound pound as they try to recover from the COVID years of adversity that have blighted the hospitality industry. But I wonder if they have considered the number of guests that choose to avoid dog-friendly venues. To be honest, I would be reluctant to pay for a hotel room that had just been occupied by a canine and its owner. And many people have allergies to animal hair. I regret to say dog-friendly establishments are no-go areas for me. There was a time when you could request a no-smoking room, so if this trend continues, perhaps guest rooms could be designated dog-free for those who don't want to share the accommodation with animal hairs, let alone any hygiene issues. Almost gone are the days of spit and sawdust country pubs with stone floors, bare wooden chairs and mongrels sitting beside mud-clad wellies. I have no problem with dogs in the bar, but perhaps they should not be allowed in the restaurant area. I don't blame the dogs, but the owners. It appears they too often don't seem to have any idea that their beloved pooches might not be everyone's favourite companion, letting them roam around, sniffing for treats and looking soulfully at your steak and chips. Let me finish by saying I like dogs, well, most of them, and realise they are an important part of their owners' lives, but I would prefer not to share a meal with them or sleep in a dog bed. That article by Peter Franzen appeared in the EDP on the 14th of December, 2024.
And to finish this week's supplement, the Norfolk parson who created Thomas the Tank Engine. Why is it that we seem to associate the clergy with railways, especially steam railways? As a child, one of my favourite films was the Ealing comedy The Titfield Thunderbolt, in which a local clergyman, ably assisted by a gaitered bishop who, acting as fireman, shovelled coal as though he were stoking the fires of hell, drove an antique engine purloined from a local museum in a race against time to keep a branch line open. If you saw it, I bet it didn't appeal to Dr. Beeching. Recently, I was able to acquire a DVD of the film, persuading myself that it was an essential part of the research for this article, not just a nostalgic piece of self-indulgence. But one clergyman, above all others, is remembered especially for his wonderful stories of a group of engines operating on the mythical island of Sodor, believed by many to be an alias for the Isle of Man. Wilbert Audrey, for 12 years vicar of Emneth, just within Norfolk on the Cambridgeshire border, was the man who created the world of Thomas the Tank Engine. He didn't set out to write a series of bestsellers, and he would, I am sure, have been astonished at the universality of the character he created and the extent to which the brand has been stretched to encompass an extraordinary range of Thomas memorabilia. He simply wanted to amuse his young son, Christopher, who was recovering from measles. His success in doing so was so great that Christopher would later write more Thomas stories for publication, extending the range of these lovely little books. In later years, both father and son introduced new character engines, but it is those early stories of Thomas, Edward, Henry, Gordon, and James the Red Engine that I best recall, and which I took most pleasure in reading in the 1980s to my sons. Almost as much pleasure as I take from the memory of my father reading them to me in the 1940s and 50s. Because Thomas started appearing before the nationalisation of the railways in 1948, in my copies of the books, Sir Topham Hatt was the fat director. Somehow he became a less entertaining figure post-nationalisation as the fat controller. Nasty word, with, for me, slightly Orwellian overtones. In the days of reprivatisation under Mrs. Thatcher, I always hoped his title would revert to director. But it was not to be. Just as well, given the government's intention is to renationalise, which means he would have to had been retitled afresh, Comptroller of the Railed Transport Division of the Ministry of Incompetence and Obfuscation, perhaps. Wilbert Audrey was born in 1911, the son of a Hampshire clergyman, but the family moved to Wiltshire when he was just 6 years old. He was educated about 14 miles from his home at Daunce's School. Railways were a major feature of his childhood. His father was an enthusiast both for model railways and the real thing. As a toddler, Wilbert would have watched with interest as his father built a model railway at the vicarage, which stretched for 40 yards. According to Wilbert, his father was so enthusiastic about trains that he acquired the nickname the Railwayman Parson. When the family moved to Wiltshire, they changed houses two or three times before settling in a house they appropriately christened Journey's End. This house was close to the Great Western Railway at a stage where it climbs a 2 mile gradient, and heavily laden goods trains struggled sometimes with the climb. Wilbert recorded much later in his life how, as a child, he had lain awake at night as the engines puffed and grunted up the incline, imagining the conversations which they might have shared had they been able to talk. And it was the conversations between his fictional engines, the arrogance of Gordon, the cheekiness of Thomas, the occasional lack of confidence in James and his pride in his red paint, that builds the characters of each individual engine in the reader's mind. It gives the parent reading to the toddler the opportunity to develop a whole range of reading voices, the gruff tones of Gordon, the cheeky cheeps of Thomas, the strident cries of Henry as he refused to leave a tunnel so the rain would not spoil his paintwork, all offer an opportunity for a parental display of dramatic skill. Mind you, I suspect that my elder son, born when I was working in Liverpool, preferred the voice of Ringo Starr in the best television version of the stories, though I thought he made them all sound the same. But life moves on, and soon Wilbert had to forego the pleasure of hearing the engines climb the hill, and after leaving Daunce's, he went up to St Peter's, Oxford, to read modern history. After graduating, he was awarded a diploma in theology at Wycliffe Hall. He then went to Jerusalem to teach at St George's School in 1933. At the time, Palestine was governed by the British under a mandate issued by the League of Nations, but it was not a calm time there. In fact, by the time he returned to England after about 3 years, revolution was in the air. Perhaps the most important result of his time in Palestine was that it was there he met his wife, Margaret, a fellow teacher, whom he married in 1938. Returning to England, he was ordained and embarked on a series of curacies, not just in his native Hampshire and his childhood Wiltshire, but also in Birmingham, where he was from 1940 to 1946. This period must have had its challenges for him. He was a pacifist, and well known to be, as a member of the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship. He was a curate in a city that was, after London and Liverpool, the most frequent target for the Luftwaffe. Hardly surprising, given its Spitfire factory at Castle Bromwich and its armaments factory at Small Heath. But his reward came when, in 1946, he became Rector of Ellsworth in Cambridgeshire and subsequently Vicar of Emneth in 1953. He stayed there until his retirement in 1965, when he moved to Gloucestershire, where he continued to write. It was while he was in Birmingham that he first came up with the idea of telling stories about a group of engines. They were told to his son, Christopher. It was his wife, Margaret, who had the idea of seeking a publisher, so we have her to thank for the first 26 books in the series, which her husband wrote. The first was published in 1945, the second a year later. This was quite an achievement. War had resulted in the rationing of paper, and during the war, something like one third of printing staff were reported to have left the industry. To succeed in finding a publisher for an unknown author was pretty difficult. The attraction was, of course, the books themselves. They charmingly displayed a more normal, cheerful, and optimistic world than that with the dangers of wartime or the austerity which continued for so long afterwards. This probably appealed as much to the adults as the bright colours and short, snappy stories did to the children. If there was a good time to launch such a genre, that was it. But it's the quality of the work which has meant that the success has never faltered. It is that quality and the appeal of the stories that have led to the translation of the books and the dubbing of the television series, which means Thomas is known from Albania to Vietnam, from Azerbaijan to Uzbekistan. Who cannot be moved by the thought of children in those places chuckling at the antics of Thomas and his friends? Wilbert Audrey was a remarkable man, an extremely well-informed railway historian, a volunteer in the cause of railway preservation, a railway model enthusiast, and a gifted storyteller. He's not been appreciated by everyone. By the 1970s, his stories were being criticised by some for supposed sexist and racist overtones. I cannot recall a single incident in any of the books from which any reasonable person could draw such an inference. I suspect those who did were those who also sought to ban the Biggles books from libraries on similar grounds. I feel sorry for their children. Their prejudice mean that they missed out on the delight of some wonderful stories. Wilbert Audrey's achievements were finally recognised with the award of an OBE in 1996. Sadly, he was not fit enough by then to travel to London to receive it. It was presented to him in his own home by the Lord Lieutenant of Gloucestershire. He died the following year and is remembered not just by a memorial window in Emneth Church, but also by a body of work appreciated around the world, which initially brought cheerfulness in dark times and is still loved today. And that item by Chris Armstrong is taken from the Norfolk Magazine January 2026 edition. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the EDP and Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our last selection of news and views, starting with fruit farms' busy winter, preparing for another bumper berry season. At a time of year more associated with hearty roast dinners, it may feel like a summertime bowl of fresh homegrown strawberries is a long way away. But with the days already lengthening, one of Britain's biggest premium berry growers is spending the winter busily preparing for another bumper season in 2026, including its ongoing efforts to extend the growing season and introduce cutting-edge new crop technologies. Place, UK's 342-hectare farm in Tunstead, near North Walsham, harvests 1,500 tonnes of strawberries from around 1.5 million plants every year on average, alongside raspberries, cherries and blackberries. In January, the first stems of its indoor-grown forced rhubarb also begin heading off to retail customers. Dan Yordanov oversees the whole operation with the support of an experienced farm team. You might associate fruit growing with warm, bright months, he said, but even in the crisp winter period, we don't stop as a team. These weeks are essential to ensure the British produce we grow next season is the very best it can be. The Place UK team picked their last strawberries in early November, marking the end of an eight-month season. Extending that season is a constant focus. We want to help our customers to sell British berries to their consumers for as long as possible. Currently, that's from April to November, added Mr. Yordanov. The last season was a bumper one, with 2025 delivering warm, favourable weather, resilient berry varieties and a healthy crop. During that time, the Place UK team harvested around 220 million berries, with each picker averaging 1,500 berries per hour during the peak summer season. In the on-site pack house, more than 8 million punnets were packed for the UK's leading supermarkets. Workers and the local community can also enjoy the mouth-watering summer produce with an on-site shop selling berries to staff and donating profits to Norwich charity The Feed, while people living near to Tunstead can buy freshly picked strawberries at Rocks and Barns. Mr. Yordanov said 2025 was a great year for blackberries too, boosted by new varieties and long cane propagation in glasshouse environments. We are close to year-round blackberry production as a sector now, he added. We're not quite there yet, but it's within reach. He predicts the farm will benefit from a rise in demand for blackberries in 2026 as UK shoppers begin to mirror American habits and seek out high-fibre, antioxidant-rich berries as part of wellness trends such as fibre-maxing. Rhubarb, meanwhile, is also enjoying a renaissance. Demand has doubled in the past 3 years, and Place UK is planning to increase production again in 2026 to meet this. A breakthrough came last year when the Place UK team proved British rhubarb could be successfully grown year-round. Stems are grown out of season in completely dark, insulated polytunnels known as forcing buildings. Our forced rhubarb, cultivated in total darkness so the plant stores glucose in the stems, has been part of the farm's winter work for more than a decade, but 2025 marked the first true year-round success, said Mr. Yordanov. Our aim is to be the first British fruit farm to grow rhubarb year-round on a commercial scale. Alongside crop work, 2025 was also a turning point for the introduction of new technology on the farm. Trials included using automated nocturnal robots with strawberry plants with beams of ultraviolet light to protect them from fungal infection, a pesticide-free method which is being expanded in 2026. The business also introduced FruitCast, using AI, artificial intelligence, to forecast yields and reduce waste, and it hosted a landmark trial of the world's first autonomous raspberry harvesting robot, partnering with Fieldwork Robotics. AI now underpins decisions across agronomy operations and marketing, said Mr. Yordanov. Place UK may be a 70-year-old family-led Norfolk business, but we're embracing the future and moving at pace. We're not just planning for next season, but projecting 5 years ahead. Even so, the winter does allow a moment to breathe. The team works incredibly hard, he added. The work continues, but we all need to take time to recharge and spend time with loved ones. Then we can come back raring to make 2026 as successful, if not even better, than 2025.
The nurse, who has been at the heart of her community, has been recognised for her vital role in accessing healthcare. Nia Haycox has been a parish nurse at the Salvation Army in Sheringham for more than 4 years, supporting those who have struggled to access traditional healthcare services. And while on holiday with her family, she found out she had been given the title of Queen's Nurse by the Queen's Nursing Institute for her commitment to her patients. She said, "I feel honoured and privileged to have been given the title of Queen's Nurse. It is a wonderful recognition of community nursing and the importance of caring for the whole person. One of the greatest benefits of being a parish nurse is being able to spend quality time with patients. Sadly, this is not always possible in other busy clinical settings. I am always able to offer time to sit with patients and support them through their medical concerns." As a parish nurse, Miss Haycox works closely with local GP practices, hospitals, pharmacies, social services and local group offering support that focuses on physical, mental, social and spiritual well-being. Alongside her one-to-one nursing work, she also runs a bereavement support group and a weekly drop-in health check clinic. She has also led a sun safety campaign for local builders and roofers last summer and has plans to launch a pedal bike safety campaign in the coming year. The Queen's Nurse title enables me to connect and network with other community-based Queen's Nurses, she added. Sharing good practice will help us continue to improve care for our communities. I encourage people to always seek support. Many people who are lonely or isolated are unaware of the support available locally. Taking that first step can often lead to life-changing and spiritually supportive opportunities. To contact Miss Haycox, call the Salvation Army in Sheringham, weekdays from 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on 01263 826 059, or email nia.haycox@salvationarmy.org.uk.
Villagers have enjoyed a rural tradition celebrating tractor power. Plough Sunday returned for its fourth year in Corston on Sunday as villagers gathered for a tractor procession and blessing aimed at marking the start of another farming season. The procession began in Sygate with over 80 villagers walking alongside 10 tractors, old and new, to Corston. A carol singing stop outside Broadland Winery added to the festive spirit. The procession then moved to Church Farm, where tractors and ploughs were blessed. The event finished at St Agnes Church with a short service involving a horse-drawn plough once used in nearby fields. Reverend Andrew Whitehead said Plough Sunday was the best yet this year, helped by the fantastic sunshine. Over 80 people came out to help us extend the season of Christmas celebrations just a little bit further. It was good to be part of the procession of tractors again on my grey Fergie, and a privilege to deliver the wise men to the church's nativity scene. A staple of East Anglian tradition, Plough Sunday marks the beginning of the agricultural year. In medieval times, Corston was home to a plough guild, which would process a plough from Sygate into the village amid singing, dancing and prayers for a fruitful harvest. St Agnes Church still houses historical artefacts from this era, including a horse-drawn plough and the former sign from the Plough Inn, which closed in the 1960s. The church also features a gallery in honour of the Plough Guild, inscribed with the wish, "God speed the plough and send us all corn in now our poor purpose for to make. At crow of cock for the ploughlet of Sygate, be merry and glad what good all ye's work made."
A couple who lost their son to suicide are urging supporters to take the plunge this winter as they continue to raise money for local mental health services. Jenny and Mark, whose 23-year-old son Stephen died in 2014, were among last year's participants in Norfolk and Waveney Mines' annual sea splash. Braving the cold sea, the Bradwell couple raised £1,186 in Stephen's memory, determined to help prevent other families from experiencing the same loss. "We lost our son Stephen to suicide in 2014, they said. He was just 23 years old and had been let down by the system repeatedly. We want to help raise funds to make sure nobody else feels so desperate that they feel suicide is the only answer." The Sea Splash, which returns on Sunday, February the 1st, challenges participants to take a short dip in the sea at one of three locations, Goulston, Southwold or Cromer. The event raises funds for Norfolk and Waveney Mind, which supports people experiencing mental health problems across the region. For Jenny and Mark, the event is about more than fundraising. It is a way to honour their son and to speak openly about the need for better mental health support. They added, "We don't want any other person to feel that suicide is the only option, and we don't want any other family to carry the pain and guilt around with them for the rest of their lives. The money raised will help support people and help in the fight for better mental health."
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. And of course, if you have a smart tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out details on our website, mardler.org.uk. But please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was David Mitchell, and the editor-producer was David Audley. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's cheerio! Cheerio.